This year is the 50th anniversary for the incredible miracles that took place in 1967. And very often when we talk about the great miracles of the Six-Day War, we only speak about Yerushalayim, and we forget about the fact that in that incredible time in history, we also recaptured Hebron. We had the ability to once again go on to the Maariv HaMachpelah and daven at the Kivrei Avos that we so long were detached from. So I decided that today it would be in tribute to next week being Yom Yerushalayim. Let's not forget about the fact that next week is also a time to celebrate Hebron. Next week is a time to celebrate the Maariv HaMachpelah. So I thought today was an important theme to speak about what the status of Maariv HaMachpelah is and whether we are even allowed to daven in the Maariv HaMachpelah. As we will see, it's not such a simple issue at all. So let's first begin with the following. We have a Mishnah, both in Maseches Tamid, as well as this Mishnah is quoted once again in Maseches Yuma, Daf Chav Ches. So the Mishnah tells us that there was somebody by the name of Masya ben Shmuel, and his job was he was Memuna al HaPayasos. He was in charge of running the morning routine in the Beis HaMikdash. And he used to galvanize all the Kohanim, get them together in a group, and he would split up, divvy up all the activities that had to be done in the morning. So he would say, this one is going to go clean off the Mizbeach, and this one is going to go bring the carbon, and he would give out all the different jobs. So Masya ben Shmuel, every morning when he started off his job of telling everybody what to do, the first thing he would say is, Heyer pnei kol ha-mizrach ad shebechevron. As we know, you're not allowed to start the avoda in the Beis HaMikdash until it's light outside, until the sun has come up. So he would ask them, has the sun already risen ad shebechevron? Does the sun already shine in Hebron? Which is a strange question. What does he care about whether or not the sun is shining in Hebron? We're not doing the sacrifices in Hebron. We're offering the karbanos in Yerushalayim. So the Gemara says the reason why he would mention about the sun shining in Hebron is kedei la'orer es zuchusam shal yeshene Hebron. In order to invoke the incredible zchus, the incredible merit of those who sleep in Hebron, which means our great avos and himos, our forefathers who are buried in Hebron, is something that we want to make sure that we invoke before we begin our daily service in the Beis HaMikdash. And Reb Chaim Kanievsky is quoted in the Sefer Tuvcha Yabiyu as saying that this is an important principle to keep in mind. He says the mere mention of Hebron, when we just talk about the avos and the himos, when we talk about Maariv HaMachpelah, and we don't even say any details about it, just we mention the fact that there is a place called Hebron, and we talk about the fact that there is a place where our fathers and mothers are buried, that's already enough to invoke Rachamei Shamayim. So we hope that by our discussion today, we will have the same like the Gemara says, that the Rachamei Shamayim, the Ribono Shel Olam's mercy, will shine down upon us, the same way it did in the Beis HaMikdash. That's the way they started every day off, to remind the Ribono Shel Olam of the Schusim of the Yavos, and we hope that will be the very same. Our history with Hebron and the Maariv HaMachpelah, as we know, dates back a very long time. It goes all the way back to Avraham Avinu. And by Avraham Avinu, I didn't put it on here, but by Avraham Avinu, we all know in Parshas Chayisara, one of the last challenges that he has in his life is that his wife Sarah passes away. And he wants to give her as much dignity as possible. He decides he's going to go out, buy this incredible plot of land. He's going to spend an exorbitant amount of money. And the plot of land that he chooses is Hebron and the Maariv HaMachpelah. So there the Pasuk says, and listen carefully, Vayakam Sedei Efron Asher B'Machpelah, Asher Lefnei Mamre. So Avraham Avinu is negotiating a deal. He wants to buy it. Hasadeh v'hamara asher bo. He buys not only the field, not only the plot of land, but he buys also the cave that was there. V'chala'etz asher basadeh. He pays not only for the cave, not only for the land, but for all the trees. He makes sure there is no part of this land that he is not going to purchase. And all of that was the Avraham lemikneh. It was a bona fide purchase. It was absolutely his. Le'enei b'nei ches. Avraham Avinu makes sure to do this transaction in front of all the locals. Everybody should be witness to the fact that Avraham Avinu is buying this piece of land. B'chol ba'ei shar iro. So everybody from the neighborhood comes. Everybody's watching how this purchase is taking place, how the transaction happens, how it plays out. Va'acharei kein. After Avraham Avinu buys the land, and now it absolutely belongs to him. Kavra Avraham es Sarah ishto el ma'aras sadeh ha-machpelah. Avraham Avinu then goes ahead and buries his wife Sarah. Al pnei mamrei hi Hebron be'eretz Canaan. So Avraham Avinu bought it. It was absolutely his. He does it in front of the whole community. He buries his wife Sarah. He would think the story is over. No. Now the Torah once again makes sure to reiterate the fact. Vayakam ha-sadeh ha-ma'ara asher bo le'Avraham le'achuzas kever me'ez b'nei ches. The Torah makes sure to remind us again that this land belonged to Avraham Avinu. Everybody signed on the deal. Everybody agreed it belonged to him. And that's the way the story ends. So Again, the reason why the Torah reiterates this point is to remind us that it is absolutely undeniable. It is something that is incontestable. It was undoubtedly true that everybody knew that Avraham Avinu bought this piece of land. And there was no one who can come later on and dispute the claim and say, no, he didn't really. You were all there. Everyone was there. Everyone was watching. Everyone was witness to the fact. And therefore, the Torah goes out of its way to mention not once, but twice, the fact that Avraham Avinu went out of his way to buy this piece of land. He paid all the money. There were no deals involved. He did everything above board. Once again, after Avraham Avinu passes away, he's buried there. Yitzchak and Rivka are buried there as well. And finally, at the very end of Yaakov Avinu's life, after he has already buried Leah there, obviously we know Rachel was buried in Beis Lechem somewhere else, but Yaakov Avinu tells his children the very same. Yaakov knows he's at the very end of his life. He gathers all of his family together. He has a discussion with them by Yitzav Osam Leimar, and he tells them very clearly. He gives the absolute instructions. Anina Esaf Alami. I know I'm at the very end of my life. I know I'm not going to live so much longer. But he says, Kivur Osi Alavosai. Make sure you bring me, not here where I pass away in Mitzrayim, make sure you bring me to the place where my parents are buried. El Hama'ara Asher B'Sdei Afron Achiti. That place, we all know what we're referring to, that place that my grandfather bought, that nobody can dispute, that nobody can deny belongs to my family, make sure you bring me there to be buried. And he goes on and he says, that's the place that my father Avraham Avinu bought. Shama Kavuras Avraham Ve'asari Ishto, that's where my grandfather Avraham, my grandmother Sarah is buried. That's where my father and mother Yitzchak and Rivka are buried. Veshama Kavarti Esleah, that Yaakov says is where I chose to bury my wife Leah. Miknei Hasadeva Hamara Sherbo Me'es B'nei Ches. That is the place that our family bought from the family of Ches. And that is the place that everybody knows, everybody was witness to the fact, belongs to our family. And the Medrash comments in Bereshis Rabbah, this is number 2 on the Sursheet. Shlosha Mekomos, there are 3 locations. She'ein ha'umos ha'olam yecholim lahonos es Yisrael. There are 3 locations where the nations of the world cannot exploit and claim against the Jewish people. V'lomar gzulim heim b'yedchem. There are 3 places which are undeniably ours. 3 places which absolutely belong to us because we purchased them. And everybody was witness to the fact that it belongs to our people. What are those 3 places? Ve'elu heim. Ma'aras ha-machpela, number 1. Har ha-bayis, number 2. Number 3, Kvuraso shel Yosef. What is that? Shechem. So you have Hebron, Shechem, and Har ha-bayis, Yerushalayim. Sheshloshtam niknu b'kesef malei. Because these 3, there was an absolute transaction. Everybody was witness to the fact. Nobody can come along later and deny. And how paradoxical is it that the 3 places that there are so many claims against the Jewish people that don't belong to us are Shechem, Hebron, and the Har ha-bayis. In fact, Rav Aviner points out, and I think it's a very powerful insight, Rav Aviner points out that most of the towns in Eretz Yisrael remained in their Jewish names, even to the Arabs. They stayed the same, pretty much the same, or an offshoot of the Hebrew name. He says there are 3 notable exceptions, and those are Shechem, which turned into Nablus. And then you have Hebron is El Khalil. They changed the name completely. And number 3, the Har ha-bayis Yerushalayim, they call Al Quds, however you say that. So Rav Aviner pointed out, how ironic is it that these 3 places that the Medrash says, we purchased, everybody knows it, they were all witness to the fact, these are the 3 places that no one can ever deny belong to the Jewish people. Those are the 3 hotspots of controversy. Those are the 3 places where the Arabs made sure to change the names to show, this is not Hebron, this is not Yerushalayim, and that is not Shechem, they don't belong to you. And how ironic is it that those are the 3 places that are most contested, that are most argued about, but those are the 3 places that are most beloved to us in the land of Eretz Yisrael. So, as we know, our history dates back a very long time to our relationship with Hebron. So it starts with Avraham and Sarah, it trickles down to Yitzchak and Rivka, and finally it goes down to Yaakov and Leah as well. But it didn't stop there. David HaMelech, the Pasuk says in Sefer Shmuel, when they anointed him to be the king, they went to Hebron. They made sure that they anointed him in Hebron, the Pasuk says. All of Beis Yehuda, the whole community came down, and they made sure that that was the place where David HaMelech was accepted as the king on the Jewish people. So again, this has a very incredible significance to our people in general. There's a slightly interesting halachic ramification to the fact that Ma'ariv HaMachpelah is so central, is so important to Hebron, and that is with regard to Hilchos Gittin. We know that when a couple unfortunately gets divorced, so the Gemara says, Mizbeach Morod Alav Demos, it's a very sad time, but yet we have to make sure that when a couple needs that, we do it in the proper way. So one of the things that has to be done is we have to write a get, and in the get that's written, we have to say exactly where this procedure is taking place. So we have to say it's taking place in Woodmere, which is near this and this river, which is near this and this community, whatever it might be, you have to give identifying details about where exactly the divorce is taking place. So here, the Shulchan Aruch discusses what happens when you write the get and you're trying to give identifying characteristics about where it is that you're writing the get. So it says you should write, you're giving it on this and this community, which is near this and this river, because rivers can never dry up. Basically, we never have a situation where a river totally dries up, so that's a very good characteristic to give. However, the Shulchan Aruch says you shouldn't write, we're giving the get in Woodmere, which is right next to this and this famous building, the Peninsula Public Library. Why? Because we never know. Maybe another 50 years, the library won't be there. People are going to say, what kind of community is that? That's not an identifying characteristic. You shouldn't say that, because you never know, a building might not be there. However, there's one notable exception. When a get is written in Hebron, if people ever get divorced there, the halacha is that you write not only that we're having the get being administered in Hebron, but we write, this is the place where we find the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. And Rav Nevin Sal was asked, why is that the case? Why is this the exception to the rule? Why, when it comes to Hebron, do we write an identifying characteristic of Ma'aris HaMachpelah, whereas in every other community where a get is written, we don't write buildings, because maybe buildings aren't going to be there, said Rav Nevin Sal, because nobody can deny the fact that the Ma'aris HaMachpelah has been around for so long, and it's going to continue to be around forever. So we don't have to worry about the fact that maybe someone's going to look at the get later on and say, what is this Hebron next to Ma'aris HaMachpelah? We know this is such a central part of our history. It's such an essential part of what Hebron is. There's no such thing as Hebron without Ma'aris HaMachpelah. And therefore, Ibn Evansal argued, this is why this is one of the notable exceptions to the rule, where when a get is administered in Hebron, we'll write, this is Hebron, the get is being written here, right next to the place which is the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. Hebron and Ma'aris HaMachpelah continue to be an incredibly important spot throughout the generations for people to offer a tefillah. And it started already in the times of the Chumash. The Gemara says in Sota, Daf Lama Dalid, when we're told about the various Meraglim and how they came to Eretz Yisrael and what exactly they did. So the Gemara says, Kalev ben Yefuna and Yehoshua ben Nun were the two who were not together with everybody else. So it says, Kalev ben Yefuna decides to veer off. And it says, Halach v'nishtateach al kivrei avos. Kalev ben Yefuna takes out time to go and offer a tefillah, that he should have the fortitude to fight against all of his friends. Kalev ben Yefuna goes to daven at none other than the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, to invoke the zchusim of his ancestors. At the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the Kinos tell us on Tisha B'Av, Az b'haloch Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu HaNavi was one of the great prophets at the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and in his last-ditch effort to try to save the Jewish people, to try to save the Beis HaMikdash from being destroyed, we're told that Yirmiyahu HaNavi goes to be mispalo, goes to offer a tefillah in Hebron. He goes to the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, and he figured, maybe that's my last chance. Maybe that's what I'm going to be able to do to save the Churban from playing out, to save the Churban from taking place. So, this is something we find in the Psukim. It's something we find later on in Tanakh by Yirmiyahu HaNavi. And then much later on in history, we find that the Rambam, at a certain point in his life, the Rambam lived in Egypt, but he also lived in Eretz Yisrael. And look at the description that the Rambam gives about his trip to Yerushalayim and his trip to Hebron. Listen what he says, and it should be a little bit of a reminder for us of what our perspective should be, perhaps, when we visit Hebron, when we visit the Kotel, when we go to Yerushalayim. What are we supposed to think about? Says the Rambam. Be'echa b'shabes tisha b'chodesh mar cheshvan. This is number gimel on the sur sheet. And it was, on the first day of the week, the ninth day of the month of Cheshvan, Yatzasi mi Yerushalayim l'Hebron. Says the Rambam, I ventured out on this fine Sunday morning to go and visit Hebron for the first time. And why did I go? Because I wanted to be Menashe Kivrei Avosai b'Ma'ara. I wanted to go and kiss the holy place where my parents were buried, where Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, where our forefathers are buried. Now listen what he says. Ve'oso hayom, and that day, Amadati b'Ma'ara, I stood there in the Ma'ara, I visited Ma'aris HaMachpelah. Ve'ispalalti, and I thanked Shvach Lekel Yizbarach HaLakol, I thanked the Ribbono Shel Olam for everything that he gave me in life. Ushnei Yamim Ha'ele, he says, and these 2 days, number one, the day I visited Yerushalayim, and number two, the day I went to visit Hebron, which are Shishi Utshi Lamar Cheshvan, 3 days apart. I came on the 6th day of Cheshvan to visit Yerushalayim. On the 9th day of Cheshvan, I went to visit Hebron. Those 2 days, says the Rambam, Nadarti, I made a promise to myself, Sheyihu Li Kamo Yamtif, that I was going to treat those 2 days because they were so meaningful to me. They made such a powerful impact on my life, says the Rambam. I took upon myself that every year, on the date when I went to visit Yerushalayim for the first time, and the date when I went to visit Hebron for the first time and have an experience to daven there, says the Rambam, Nadarti, I took a promise upon myself, Sheyihu Li Kamo Yamtif, that I'm going to treat those 2 days like a Yamtif, like a festive day on the calendar. Utfila v'simcha behem v'achila v'shtia, and I'm going to rejoice on those days, and I'm going to make sure to add special tfilos on those days, because what greater schus, what greater merit can I have than to go and have the opportunity to visit Yerushalayim and Hebron? And when you read the words of the Rambam, that he actually put it down on his calendar, that every year he has to celebrate and mark the day when he went to Yerushalayim. How many of us think about that? We come to Yerushalayim, we're so blessed to be there as often as we want. We can go to Hebron whenever we want. How many of us think about the fact that the Rambam, when he actually visited, took that down as, from now on, this is going to be a day on my calendaric year that I'm going to celebrate. Like Hanukkah, like Purim, like Pesach, like Shavuos. These 2 days are very important days in the life of the Rambam. And they should be important experiences for us as well. At least once a year, when we have the opportunity to thank the Ribono Shel Olam on Yom Yerushalayim or other experiences that we have, we should think about the fact how blessed we are, how lucky we are to have this experience as often as we want, and to go and visit Hebron, and to go and visit Yerushalayim, and to offer our tefillos, and to have a relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. Now, just a quick recap of the history, and it's going to be important for later on in this year, so it's not just a history lesson, but it's important. In the year 1267, so we had a long-standing relationship with Hebron, but in the year 1267, the Muslim leadership took over the ownership of Hebron, and they made some sort of prohibition. They outlawed any Jew or any Christian to enter into the Ma'aros HaMachpelah. And it was from that time on, from 1267 until 1967, which in higher mathematics is 700 years. It's a long time. For 700 years, the Jewish people were not allowed access and entry into the Ma'aros HaMachpelah. And that's a very critical part of the history that's going to be relevant to the halacha part of the shir as well. For 700 years, the Jews were not allowed to enter into the Ma'aros HaMachpelah. And as we know, there was that seventh step that they famously allowed the Jews to stand on. And not only did they say any Jew who was caught going into Ma'aros HaMachpelah would lose their life, but any Muslim or Arab soldier who was paid off to allow a Jew to go in was also punishable with death. So this is how seriously they took it. They did not allow any Jews to enter into the Ma'aros HaMachpelah for around 700 years. One of the great Gedolim in Italy writes in his Sefer that he was so excited that he met once in his life a shliach from Hebron. He met somebody who was visiting Italy from Hebron, and he stopped him in the street and he asked him, "Nu, what's doing in Hebron? What's with the Ma'aros HaMachpelah? Is it true that no one's allowed to go there? Is it true that you're not allowed to daven there anymore?" And he turns to him and he says, "Yes, ha'emesu, the truth is, she'ein reshus l'shum adam l'hikanes l'sham. No one is allowed to go in there." And he says, it's an onesh misa, af l'hashomer yishmal ha'yoshev sham, imaniach l'echad l'hikanes. If a soldier would allow someone to go in, they bribed him or whatever it might be, and that soldier was caught, this shliach from Hebron told the Rav in Italy, "I want you to know this is how seriously they take it. It's such an egregious crime in their thought that they would even punish the soldier with death, not only the Jew, but they would punish the soldier with death as well." And then we had the incredible Simcha Gedola in 1967. We had this unbelievable experience on so many levels. It was an unbelievable period in history when we recaptured not only Yerushalayim, but we were able to recapture once again Hebron and the Ma'aros HaMachpelah. And that's the way it stayed from 1967 until 1993. We had access to Hebron. It actually was under our sovereignty, under our control. There was a major controversy about why we gave some other nations the rights to come back into the Ma'aros HaMachpelah and Hebron. We're not getting into the politics, but in 1993, unfortunately, there was a big, shall we say, pigua in Hebron, a little hiccup that took place with Baruch Goldstein. And then after that, the Israeli government realized we have to do something, so we have to split Hebron. We have to split the mosque, or the place of worship in Ma'aros HaMachpelah, and they decided we're going to give some of it to the Arabs, we're going to keep some of it for ourselves. Now, it was a very unfair split. They ended up with about 85% of the Ma'aros HaMachpelah, and we ended up with less than 20%, which is very strange. We captured it. We won the war. Six-day war. The Jewish people won. There was no question about it. 1967, we recaptured Maariv HaMachpelah and the whole city of Hebron. We shouldn't have given back anything. But yet we gave back a portion of it. You would say, okay, so give back, make a concession, give back a little bit. You give back 85% to the Maariv HaMachpelah and keep less than 20% for yourselves. Well, that's what happened, and that's where we stand today. We have only a portion of the Maariv HaMachpelah, but at least we're blessed enough to be able to have that opportunity to go and pray, to go and offer a tefillah in the Maariv HaMachpelah. And for the remainder of the shiur, what I'd like to discuss is it actually permissible for us to daven, to offer a tefillah in the Maariv HaMachpelah? It might surprise some people to know that the Stipler, who was one of the great gedolim of the previous generation, the Stipler, they write in his biography, that he was careful never to enter into the Maariv HaMachpelah. He felt there was no halachic grounds to allow a person to enter the Maariv HaMachpelah to offer a tefillah, and therefore he said even after they recaptured the Yerushalayim and Hebron, the Stipler said that he made sure to stay on the step on the outside of the Maariv HaMachpelah. He did not see any halachic justification for entering into the Maariv. What is that all about? Why would there be any objection to entering into the Maariv HaMachpelah? The story begins as follows. We have a pasuk in Parshas Va'era, number Dalet. So in Parshas Va'era, we have many of the makos playing out in Mitzrayim. And Moshe Rabbeinu negotiates with Paro, and he warns him, and he lets him know, by the way, this makos is going to come unless you let the Jewish people go free. And Paro is being very stubborn, and he refuses to give in. And then after the makos comes, Paro realized, I got to do something about this. My whole country is going to be destroyed. So after many of the makos, he goes and pleads with Moshe Rabbeinu that Moshe Rabbeinu should ask that the makos is removed from the land of Mitzrayim. So, once again, in the middle of Makas Barad, that's what takes place. Moshe Rabbeinu warns Paro that this is what's going to happen. Paro comes running after Moshe Rabbeinu after the Makkah begins, and he says, oh, I can't handle this. What's going to be? The whole country is going to be destroyed. We have thunder, we have lightning, we have hail, we have things flying from the sky. We can't have this. He asks Moshe Rabbeinu to please remove it. So you imagine the scene. Moshe Rabbeinu, I don't know, the same way they sing the story, Paro in pajamas, Moshe Rabbeinu is probably in pajamas. So Moshe Rabbeinu is in the middle of sleeping in the middle of the night. Paro comes knocking on his door. And he says, please, look, the whole country is being destroyed. I need you to get rid of this makkah. Moshe Rabbeinu says, excuse me, give me a few minutes. Hey. Paro is probably yelling at him, what do you mean give you a few minutes? I asked you to get rid of it. Take care of this before the whole country is destroyed, before everything is taken out by the barad. Moshe Rabbeinu says, hey, I'm not able to daven right now. I have to walk out of the city. You have to walk out of the city? Do you know how far the walk is from where you live to outside of the city of Mitzrayim? Moshe Rabbeinu, I assume, lived in the middle of everything. He's being there, he's one of the politicians negotiating with Paro. He probably lived pretty close by. He says, no. Kitsesiyasayir. I'm going to take my jolly old time. I'm going to go out of Mitzrayim. I'm going to go offer a tefillah once I get out of Mitzrayim. And then we'll consider whether or not God should stop the Makkah. So listen what the Pasuk says. Look at number Dalit. Vayomer elav Moshe. So Paro is probably down Moshe Rabbeinu's throat. He's asking, please, do whatever you can. Get rid of this Makkah. We can't handle it. Moshe Rabbeinu responds to him and he says, Kitsesi Esair, when I leave the city of Mitzrayim, you caught me at a bad time. I'm in the middle of doing whatever I'm doing. I'm in the middle of sleeping or eating dinner with my kids. I'm in the middle of Mitzrayim. Says Moshe Rabbeinu, Kitsesi Esair, when I have the opportunity to leave Mitzrayim, Ephros es kapai el Hashem. Then, when I leave Mitzrayim, I will offer a tefillah. I'll raise my hands in prayer to the Ribono Shel Olam. And then, Hakolos yechtelun v'habarad lo yeod. And then, after I leave the city and I offer the tefillah, then everything is going to stop. Lemanteida ki la Hashem haaretz. In order that you should know that God is the one who is in charge of the land. So if you really want to prove that God is in charge of the land, why don't you just offer a tefillah right here? It will stop immediately, and everybody will know why it stopped. Why do you have to leave the city? What's that all about? Says Rashi. Rashi there on the pasuk explains, quoting a mechilta. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to leave the city? Avo besochayir Moshe lo hispalel. In the middle of the city, Moshe refused to offer a tefillah. Why? Lefishahaisa melea gilulim. Because the city was full of, what's gilulim? Is that really what gilulim means? That's the way we translate it, but that's not really what it means. What is galal? Gimel lamin lamin means excrement from an animal. So the same way one is not allowed to offer a tefillah in the ladies' room or the men's room, so too you're not allowed to offer a tefillah if you're on a barn and it smells and it's disgusting and it's not a comfortable place, you're not allowed to offer a tefillah there. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, the whole Mitzrayim is full of galal, from the animals, and therefore you're not allowed to offer a tefillah. Why is Mitzrayim full of that? So the Ramban and other Rishonim explain that's not what it means here. It means the whole Mitzrayim is full of Avodah Zarah. And Avodah Zarah in our minds is the same as that. And therefore, says Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm not allowed to offer a tefillah here. The same way I would never dare to offer a tefillah in a barn, so too I'm not going to offer a tefillah here in the middle of Mitzrayim. I'm going to walk out of the city. I'm going to offer my tefillah once I leave. And then you'll see everything is going to stop. So from here we learn a very important halacha. Moshe Rabbeinu teaches us that we have no right to offer a tefillah in a place which is a makom avodah zarah. You're not allowed to offer a tefillah in a place which houses avodah zarah, and this is why Moshe Rabbeinu chooses to leave Mitzrayim in order to offer his tefillah. Now the Achronim take this a step further and they have a discussion. Should we assume that this is only with regard to a tefillah that a person is not allowed to offer in a makom hamatunath, as we call it? How do you translate that? Makom hamatunath. It's a place that is unsanitary, that is unsoiled. I don't know exactly what you say, but it's a foul odor, something like that. Is it only that you're not allowed to offer a tefillah there, or you're not allowed to perform any mitzvah in such a location? So, for example, one of the great gedolim in the 1600s was the Shalos HaTshuvos Halachas Katanos. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Chagiz. He was the one who was fighting, one of the great people who was fighting against Shabtai Tzvi in his generation. He was a Rav in Morocco later on. He moved to Yerushalayim. So in the Halachas Ketanos, he writes the following. Would we say that you're not allowed to perform any mitzvah in a place which is dirty, any mitzvah in a place which has a foul odor? So he says, you can probably prove it from the following. Anyone in this room has ever had the great misfortune of visiting a slaughterhouse? Ever been there? There's an awful smell. It smells horrible. And yet we go ahead, says the Halachas Ketanos, and we perform the mitzvah of Shechita many, many thousands of times a day, even though the conditions are terrible. So he says, how are you allowed to do that? You should have to slaughter one animal at a time and then go somewhere else. How can you perform a mitzvah in a place which is so unsanitary, which is so dirty, which is so smelly? Says the Halachas Ketanos, it must be that this halacha is only relevant to tefillah. How can I offer a tefillah? How can I open my mouth and represent myself to the Ribono Shel Olam in a place which is so dirty, which is so unkempt? And therefore he writes that he believes that from the fact that we do shechita in a slaughterhouse, and the slaughterhouse is not an attractive place to be at all, therefore he says it would seem that this only applies and we limit it only to tefillah. We do not transfer this halacha to other mitzvahs. The Prima Gadim has a discussion. Let's say when I'm going to build my sukkah, do I have to make sure that all the conditions around where the sukkah is going to be built are going to be fit for where a mitzvah should be done? Or do you say, no, I build my sukkah, I sit in the sukkah, it's not my business what's going on around or outside the sukkah, whatever happens there, happens there. What happens inside the sukkah is what's important to us. Is this important to think about every time we do a mitzvah, that we do it in a proper place? So, there's a discussion that some might find to be irrelevant and something that's inconsequential, but the Mishneh Berurah quotes from the Mate Ephraim, a case that actually came up last year. Somebody asked me a shaila last year. It was a little too late, but they asked the shaila before Rosh Hashanah. The shaila was, their family goes up to the country for Rosh Hashanah. And they said that they have a bungalow right next door to the shul. And they can see right into the windows. They can hear the chazan howling all the time from the shul. They can hear everything. So this woman who has young children said, I'm not able to get a babysitter up in the mountains. I'm not able to have my husband come home in the middle of shul. How can he do that? So she asked me, am I able to stay at home and listen to the shofar from next door? I'm not going to be in shul, but I'll hear everything, just like I hear the chazan, I can hear the shofar. So that's a discussion about whether or not that works, and the halacha is that yes, it does work. So she asked me, can she stay home instead of trying to make a heroic effort to go to shul? Can she just listen from next door? I said yes. It turns out after Rosh Hashanah, the woman told me the following. That as it turns out, it's a little strange question, but this is what she said. As it turns out, she was waiting, taking care of her kids, listening to where they were up to in shul, then she had to use the ladies' room. It turns out, they get up to tekiah shofar, and she's not even in a position where she's able to listen. So I said, it's an interesting shaila, but the Mishneh Berurah actually talks about it. And it has to do with this discussion. Is a person allowed to perform the mitzvah of tekiah shofar? Again, you're not the one who's going to blow the shofar. You wouldn't perform a mitzvah in such a place. But now I find myself in a situation where I'm answering, I'm listening. How am I allowed to do that? Can I actually perform my mitzvah? You'll say it's a very unusual shaila, but in my very short lifetime it happened. So it's quite interesting. So this is what the Mishneh Berurah writes, and he says he thinks that one cannot perform any mitzvah. It's not only limited to tefillah, he says. It's not right. How can you perform any mitzvah? After all, whenever we do a mitzvah, We consider that to be some kind of avoda, some kind of relationship that we're building with the Ribono Shel Olam. How can you build a relationship in a place like that? And therefore he writes, it's not a good idea. Again, by the time I was asked the shaila, it was too late. But that was the shaila that was asked. The shaila went a little bit further, which is interesting because in the times, in many generations in Europe, this was actually a reality. So one of the great Talmidim of Reb Chaim Volozhiner discusses in his tshuva about the person who was thrown into solitary confinement. It happened every so often in Europe that they threw someone into prison, and only three times a week they would drop some food into the prison cell. It was terrible conditions. And what did you have in there? Nothing. All they gave you was a little hole in the ground and a couple of rations of food for the week, and that was it. You were on your own. So this person knows he's going to be in solitary confinement for a very extended period of time. So the shaila was asked, and this was obviously a very relevant shaila in the times of those generations in Europe, and Baruch Hashem, we don't have to deal with this so much more, but there were people who were thrown into prison. Sometimes it wasn't really justified that they were thrown in, and they knew they would be there for an extended period of time. What are you going to tell me? I can never daven, I can never learn, I can never say Kriya Shema. I'm not allowed to perform any mitzvah for the months and months at a time that I'm going to be there? So this was a very important shaila that was discussed at the time. Do you tell the person, well, maybe we should just tell them to violate this prohibition of offering a tefillah in such a place, because after all, what are you going to do? You're not going to daven for the next 6 months? What if you're in there for the next 5 years? You're not going to daven, you're not going to keep Shabbos, you're not going to do anything? How can we tell you to do such a thing? Every time you take food into your mouth, you're not going to make a bracha. So this was the shaila that was asked, and surprisingly, the Mishnah Berurah comes to the conclusion, I guess this was a shaila in his days as well. He says, "Mutav lo shelo yispal al klal." It's better that a person should sit there for months at a time. Don't offer any davening. You don't have a right to violate this prohibition of offering a tefillah in a place which is not the proper conditions, he says. Mutav lo shelo yispal al klal. Even if it means 6 months are going to go by or 6 years are going to go by, you're not allowed to perform any mitzvah there. Again, this was a big discussion at the time. Apparently it was a very relevant discussion. Now we don't really deal with it so much, but it was a major discussion throughout the generations. So you'll say the person's going to go crazy and they need to keep their sanity, they need to do something. Okay, those are different stories. Somebody asked last night at the shir, what about in the times of the Holocaust? So unfortunately, in the times of the Holocaust, there were many situations where people performed mitzvahs under the conditions that obviously were not the greatest for performing mitzvahs, to put it lightly. I had the great fortune yesterday. I came to shul. My son woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he decided that we're going to shul. So we came to shul, and we came to the minyan. I had the great fortune that there was somebody here who was a Holocaust survivor. And after davening, I brought my son over to meet him, and I asked this man to give my son a bracha. What greater privilege can you have than to meet someone who is a survivor of the Holocaust, who kept to the faith, and who's still coming to shul? It's an incredible challenge. We hope never to be challenged with again, but it was an incredible blessing. And my son didn't fully understand exactly what it meant. He's only 6 years old, but still, he understood that there was something called the Holocaust, and there were heroic Jews, and this is one of them. I explained to him a little bit that it's an incredible gift when you have the opportunity. I don't think he ever, maybe a few times in his life he met, but the next generation, I'm not sure how many of them are actually going to ever meet a person. So when we talk about such things and the heroic efforts that they took to perform mitzvahs, whether it was right or was wrong, it doesn't really matter. I remember Rav Asher Weiss once said the following. It's actually funny how it happened. He asked me when I was 20 years old to come with him once to a certain community. He had never been there before. And he asked me if I would join him for a Shabbos. I said, sure. So I came with him for Shabbos. He was very uncomfortable. He didn't know anybody there. He was never in such a community. So we went together, and in the middle of one of his talks, somebody asked a question, clearly just trying to throw him off. It was a question that had nothing to do at all with the shir. It was a totally irrelevant question, and was just trying to get him to say something that he shouldn't say. So he didn't want to be disrespectful, but he said the following, and it was the whole question that this person asked was worth it just for that response. He said that he once read the Kovno Ghetto Diaries. And in there, he said there's a story about Moshe Goldkorn. And I was so moved by the story, and I've said it over many times since I heard it then, that Moshe Goldkorn was a Jew who was in the Kovno Ghetto, and he was in at that point it was a labor camp, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And every day his job was to go out and do some kind of work in the fields. And he decided, it was a few months before Pesach, he has to start getting himself ready to bake matzahs for Pesach. Can you imagine? This is what he's thinking about, 6 months before Pesach. So he decided to make a small hem in the bottom of both of his pants, and he was going to save, whenever he would find a kernel of wheat in the field somewhere, he was going to save it in the bottom of his pants. And as he was a chassid, so he used to go, chassidim always make matzahs only on Erev Pesach, so he decided he's going to save it up, and Erev Pesach, he's going to crush all the wheat, he's going to bake the matzah, and he's going to try to eat the matzah on the night of the Seder. So this is what happens. The whole ghetto knew. Everybody was aware that this person was being Moser Nefesh, and that he was saving all the wheat kernels, and that he was planning to use them on Erev Pesach to build his matzah. So Erev Pesach comes, he goes ahead, he crushes up the wheat, and he makes it into matzah, and he's very excited that he's going to perform his mitzvah. And in the last minute, right after the matzah was baked, some officer comes and finds and uncovers what it is that he had done, and crushes the matzah into pieces and knocks out all of his teeth. And now he has a bloody mouth, and he's walking around the ghetto not knowing what to do with himself. The Rav of the Kovna ghetto sees out of his window that this Jew is walking toward his home. And the Rav is thinking to himself, what am I going to tell him? He's probably going to ask me, how does God do this to me? Doesn't he see? Doesn't God know how much I gave up on myself? Doesn't God know how much I sacrificed to do his mitzvah? And this is what I get? This is the reward I get for doing that? So the Rav is trying to figure out, what can I possibly tell this Jew when he comes to my house to knock on the door to complain about his fate? The Jew knocks on the door, and the Rav is silent. He doesn't know what to tell him. And the Jew says, I just have one question. He says, what's the question? He says, you know, I've been saving up this matzah for the last few months, and I went out of my way to bake the matzah today because I wanted to eat it tonight. Now the matzah is in little pieces. I have no teeth left because they knocked out all my teeth, and my mouth is bloody. I want to know, I'm a chassid. Usually the chassidim follow the practice that they don't eat gebruchs. But this year I have no teeth, so I want to know, can I drink the matzah? This is what Jews were worried about in the Kovna ghetto. And what Rav Asher Weiss responded at that time was, what the answer that was given is irrelevant. It's questions like that that kept the Jewish people alive and will continue to keep the Jewish people alive. It's people that were concerned under those conditions about things like that, about whether or not they can violate the minhag of the Hasidim, not to eat gebruchs. That's why the Jewish people are still here. And whatever answer the rabbi gave is completely irrelevant. It doesn't make a difference. It always bothers me when people quote from the Tshuvas Mimam Akim. That's Rabbi Ephraim Ushri's responsa that he wrote after the Holocaust about all the questions he was asked. And they treat that sefer like any other sefer. And they argue and they say, oh, was he right? Was he wrong? Who cares if he was right or he was wrong? Look at what's going on in the book. Look at the fact that people were willing to ask these questions. Who cares if he gave the right or wrong answer? It's the fact that people had such strength, had such courage to ask such questions under those conditions. So somebody asked last night, oh, you're telling me if someone's in solitary confinement, the Mishnah Berurah writes they're not allowed to do a mitzvah, how do they do the mitzvahs in the concentration camp? The answer is, it doesn't matter. They did what they felt they had to do. Whether it was right or was wrong, I'm sure God was very proud of everyone who did whatever they did. And I don't think it's our place to have to worry about whether it was halachically correct or maybe not correct, or maybe the Tshuvas Mimam Akim made a mistake, maybe he gave the right psak, he gave the wrong psak. It's so irrelevant. There are some questions in history that are more important than any answer we can possibly give. I think it's something to consider. So it's clear from all the sources that when a person encounters a makam hamatunaf, a place which is contaminated, a place which is unkempt, a place which is inappropriate to perform a mitzvah, or a makam avodah zarah, like Moshe Rabbeinu says. In my mind, says Moshe Rabbeinu, that's the same. A place which is infused with avodah zarah is the very same as a place which is contaminated. One is not allowed to daven, perhaps one is not allowed to perform any mitzvah. So now, let's talk about the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. And what we have to discuss is the Ma'aris HaMachpelah for those 700 years when it was under the control of the Islamic people, or the Muslims, whoever was in charge there. It was being used as a mosque. It was being used as a mosque. And the question is, how do we view a mosque? How do we view the Nation of Islam? Is that considered to be Avodah Zarah? If it's considered to be Avodah Zarah, perhaps you'll say, maybe they used this as a mosque, maybe they destroyed our place, our holy site of the Ma'aris HaMachpelah, and maybe it has now turned into a base Avodah Zarah where we don't have a right, like Moshe Rabbeinu, we don't have a right to offer a tefillah here. So the story begins as follows. The Ran writes in Maseches Sanhedrin. Now again, there is so much literature on the topic. We're only going to oversimplify the issue just to give the main points, but there's so much more to discuss. So we're just going to give the main highlights of the sugya. The Ran writes in Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis, number Hey on the source sheet. Says the Ran, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, Vilamadnu Mikan, and we learn from here, Shehakedoshim Shel Agoyim, that those holies that the non-Jews look up to, Vegam HaMeshuga, Shel HaYishma'elim, who is that? Mohammed, it says. Afal pi she'enam tolem achareyem la'asosem alahu, says the Ran. I don't believe that they treat Mohammed as a god. Mikal makum still, says the Ran, holu mishtachavim lifneyem mishtachavo shel alahu, since they bow down to Mohammed, din avodah zarah yesh lahem l'chol davar. Says the Ran, we consider Islam to be an avodah zarah for all intents and purposes. It is an absolute avodah zarah. And the Rambam very famously disagrees. The Rambam says, I'm a theologian. I know all about religion. This is not true. Says the Rambam, not true at all. Look at number Vav. The Rambam has this in a tshuva in two places. He has it once again in Machalas Asuras. The Rambam has it in a few places. Elu ha-yishma'elim. He says, our perspective toward the Muslim religion is, Einam of the Avodah Zarah klal. He says, that's not called Avodah Zarah. After all, it's a monotheistic religion. They do believe in the same God we believe in. Says the Rambam, Kvar nichrasa mipiyam umilibam. They have declared openly, they have stated, V'hem yachadim lakel yiz'ale yichud karai. They designate our God the same way we do. So again, says the Rambam, you cannot consider that Avodah Zarah if they believe in God. It's a monotheistic religion. And I looked online yesterday to find out, what exactly do the Muslims say when they bow down on the ground? Anybody know? You always see them kneeling on the ground. What do they say? No. So they say in English, I mean they say it in Arabic, I guess, but they say in English, how perfect is my Lord the Great? So you see the Rambam is correct. Look what he says. They proclaim the fact that they believe in God. When they bow down on the floor, they say, we believe in God. They're not saying, they're not pledging to Muhammad. And therefore, says the Rambam, we do not consider that Avodah Zarah. It's a monotheistic religion. And therefore, he argues, that is not considered Avodah Zarah at all. Because they believe in the same God that we do. That's the opinion of the Rambam against the opinion of the Ran. But now, although it's true that they might believe in God, and although it's true that when they bow down on the ground, they pledge allegiance to the same God that we do, there's a further complication. Because they believe in God plus. So they believe that God has, I don't know, shall we call it co-conspirators, or God has partners or other participants in the decision-making process. What's the story when a Jew believes in God plus? Let's say I'm a ma'amin ba'kadosh baruch hu, I believe that God is the one all-powerful, he's the one in charge, but I also believe that he has some partners involved. Says the Gemara, kala mishatev, shem shamayim v'davar acher, number zayin. If you have a Jew who is mishatev shem shamayim v'davar acher, shituf means, if you believe there's a partnership between God and somebody else, if you believe God has any helpers, says the Gemara, Nekar min ha'olam, you will be uprooted from the world. You're not allowed to believe that. Part of our faith is not only that we believe in God and monotheism, but that we believe that God is the Yachid u'miyuchad. When we say every day, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, it means He is the Yachid u'miyuchad. He is unique, He is different, He is special, there's nothing else like Him, and there is nobody else in the equation. That's what the Gemara tells us. And this is what the Rambam reiterates in number Ches as well, that we have no right to believe as Jews that God has any other partners. And this is why over the generations there was some controversy about certain tefillos that we offer. That's Reb Chaim Volozhiner and others. We're very against the fact that on Friday night people sing Shalom Aleichem, but in that they say, Barchuni l'shalom. How can you ask the Malachim to bless you? They're not in a position to give you a blessing. If you're going to be blessed, God is going to decide that you should be blessed. It has nothing to do with the malachim. So my family has the practice like Reb Chaim Volozhiner, that's the Soloveitchik practice, that they didn't say Barchuni L'Shalom because some say it's inappropriate. How can you ask the malachim to give you a blessing? The malachim are not in a position to bless you. Either God wants you to have the blessing in life or not. And for that matter, we're all familiar with the famous part of Slichos that we say, Machnisei Rachamim. We ask that the malachim should have mercy on us. Right? Everybody knows the song and the tefillah that we say. What are we asking for? We ask that the Malachim should have mercy on the Jewish people. How can we ask that the Malachim have mercy? It's not in their power to have mercy. It's God who's going to have mercy on the Jewish people. So again, the same way when you go to a great tzaddik or tzidkanius and you ask, can you daven for me? We have to keep in mind, you're not asking that they should perform the miracle. You're asking, because you have such a close relationship with God, please offer a tefillah on our behalf that He should think about us. But not that the person themselves is going to perform anything for you. You don't put your trust in anyone else but God Himself. You know that ultimately it comes from God. And this is a mistake people often make. When you go to daven by a kever, sometimes people ask their parents, can you please do this and that for me? The parent can't do anything for you. You can ask the parent to use their schusim, to use their merits, and that should be good for your family. But to daven to the dead person themselves, that's highly inappropriate, and the Gemara says it's called Dorish Al HaMesim. It's what the Pasuk says, it's a biblical prohibition. You're not allowed to ask a tefillah, you're not allowed to offer a tefillah to a dead person. You have to offer the tefillah to the Ribono Shel Olam, and you can ask that in the schus, in the merit of this great person, or everything they did in their lifetime, that something good should happen to you now. Yeah?
Why can't that be applied to Baruch Hu Shalom? You're asking them for their relationship with the Kaddish Baruch Hu.
That's correct.
You're not asking the Malachim to give you a bracha.
So that's what some say. You're not asking the Malachim to give you a bracha. You're just asking that they should intervene and ask God to have mercy on you the same way you can ask a tzaddik. Again, this is all part of the major discussion. But when you look at the words, it says, Barchuni l'shalom. You're asking not, please go ahead and do something on my behalf and ask God to invoke His mercy, but you're asking, please give me a blessing. Or, machnisei rachamein, or you're asking, please have rachmanis on me. What do you mean? The malach doesn't have the position to have rachmanis on me or not. So again, that's the major discussion. Not for now, maybe we'll talk about it elo time when we think about all the slichos, but this is a major discussion. So it's clear that a Jew is not allowed to believe in monotheism plus something else. It's either you believe in God by himself, or you don't believe in anything. So the question is, what's the story with regard to a non-Jew? Is a non-Jew, we know one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach is, a non-Jew is not allowed to serve Avodah Zarah. So they believe in one God. They believe in monotheism. Sometimes you have a Buddha who believes in a real other God, not in the God that we believe in. That's real Avodah Zarah. That's violating the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. But here, when you have a religion that believes in one God, the same God we believe in, do we say that they're also considered Ovdei Avodah Zarah because they believe in God plus his partners? Or would you say, no, maybe only Jews have the prohibition of believing in God plus. But the non-Jews, maybe you'll say, they're not prohibited to believe in God plus one. So you'll say, what difference does it make? Is the non-Jew ever asking us to shaila whether or not he should believe in Muhammad? Why are we discussing this? You know what the answer is? Shulchan Aruch says is a major consequence, lahalacha. That consequence is, am I ever allowed to go into business with a non-Jew? What's it my business whether I'm in a business deal with him? Says the Shulchan Aruch, because what happens? You make a good real estate deal. What's the first thing a person's going to do when they have a good deal? They're going to go run, pray to the God to say, thank you for the great deal I just made. That means you're causing them to go and serve Avodah Zarah. Says the Shulchan Aruch, this is a major consequence. Should we assume that when they serve Muhammad plus God, right? When they serve anything else plus the monotheistic religion that we believe in, is that considered to be like they're serving Avodah Zarah? The same way if a Jew did that, it would be Avodah Zarah? Imagine if one of our children came along and said, okay, I still believe in God, but I also believe in Muhammad. You would say, it's probably not what we want from our children. That's certainly a form of a very serious violation of being Ovid Avodah Zarah. But the question is, for a non-Jew, is it considered to be the same as for a Jew? And again, as we mentioned, this is a major consequence. Should we ever be allowed to go into business with a non-Jew because we have to be concerned that the same way I'm not allowed to make a Jew do an Aveira, I'm not allowed to go to someone and give them a non-kosher sandwich and say, here, this is delicious, go ahead and eat it. That would be a violation of Lifnei Iver. I'm not allowed to set someone up for a disaster. So too, I'm not allowed to set up a non-Jew to do an Aveira, which means if he's going to serve Avodah Zarah by the deal that he makes with me, says the Shulchan Aruch, maybe you're not allowed to make the deal because you're going to be responsible for his serving Avodah Zarah. So that's the question. It's a very important consequence that comes about from this discussion. So this was a major discussion in the Gedolei Achronim in the 1800s. Should we assume that Christianity and Islam are considered to be monotheistic religions and therefore we say it's not Avodah Zarah? Or do you say, no, that's not safe from Avodah Zarah. That's still Avodah Zarah. Why? Because, after all, they serve the same God plus one. So maybe that should still be a problem of Avodah Zarah. Soloveitchik took the approach, he felt it was still Avodah Zarah. There are many who misquote him today. Perhaps Soloveitchik said he took the approach that Christianity is considered Avodah Zarah, and I don't know, Islam, I don't know if he spoke about, but Christianity, he definitely had very strong feelings toward, and he felt that was Avodah Zarah. And that's why he was very serious about his convictions that a person should never do interfaith dialogue and all these different things. He did feel it was Avodah Zarah. So, again, as we mentioned, we had the disagreement between the Rambam and the Ran, his contemporaries, about whether or not in the first place we consider them to be of the Avodah Zarah. Do they believe in one God? The Rambam says, what are you talking about? We know that Islam believes in one God. We know they believe in the same God that we do. However, the further discussion is, should we assume that even though they believe in God, but since they add on other co-conspirators to God, maybe we should say that that's also considered a prohibition of Avodah Zarah, or perhaps not. So that's a major discussion about what our views are toward Islam. Either way, let's not forget, the Binyan Sion, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, one of the great Gedolim who lived in Germany, writes in his Tshuva, make no mistake, even though Christianity might not be Avodah Zarah for them, it's certainly Avodah Zarah for us. There's nothing to talk about. It's certainly Avodah Zarah for us. However you come out on the issue with regard to their serving Avodah Zarah, am I allowed to do business with them? Do I have to be concerned maybe they're going to go ahead and thank their God? It's a different discussion. With regard to me, if my children decide one day, oh, let's go ahead and serve our God plus Muhammad or anybody else, says the Binyan Seal, let's make no mistake, this is clearly Avodah Zarah with regard to us. And not only that, the Divrei Yetziv, who was one of the great Gedolim after the Holocaust, the Kloizimiger Rebbe, he survived the Holocaust, so he said in his tshuva, because there's a very strong argument to make that Islam and Christianity might not be Avodah Zarah, therefore, says the Divrei Yetziv, we have to be all the more careful. We have to be all the more careful because we're blurring the lines and we're saying, well, maybe it's not so bad, maybe it's not really Avodah Zarah for them. He says you have to go out of your way, not to get anywhere near it, not to show an interest. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the Torah says, you're not allowed to show an interest in any other religion. So what does that mean? It means I'm not allowed to go and do what? You can't show an interest. That's very subjective. Everybody has different levels of interest. So you're not allowed to go into the church. Rav Soloveitchik took it so far as to say, you're not even allowed to watch when President Kennedy lost his life and they had the service in the cathedral. So Rav Soloveitchik felt that was also part of this prohibition. You're showing an interest in the service that they do in their church. Even though I would have said on my own, that's really a funeral, it's not really a service. But he said, no, that's part of the service that they do. You're not allowed to express any interest. So again, that's a chiddush. That's a chiddush in itself. And it's debatable whether or not we assume that way. But many people ask often when they go to Rome and they want to visit in the... What? They want to visit the Vatican. That's a very, very serious question. Isn't that showing interest in a religion other than the Jewish religion? So... So this is a, certainly don't have to dance with the Pope, but so this is the major question about what our views are toward Islam. And as we said, it has major consequences. So let's take this all back in, let's rein it back into the discussion about Maros HaMachpelah. The Tzitz Eliezer writes in his tshuva, Tzitz Eliezer was one of the great Gedolim, he passed away about 10, 15 years ago. Tzitz Eliezer writes on the very bottom of the page, Kayotze bazeh ha'erosi, al ha'tfilo sha'orchim ka'es. He says, I don't understand. We have tfilos. We all go and daven in the binyan shel Ma'aris HaMachpelah. How do we go ahead and daven in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah? He says, D'kefi she'einenu haros. We all open our eyes and we see. Ha'makom bifnim. That this space, the space of the Ma'aris HaMachpelah inside. Now again, from 1967 to 1993, which is when this tshuva was written, the whole Ma'ar was open to everybody. So you had Jews and non-Jews alike all praying in the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. Now imagine the scene. You have your minion is davening mincha right here, and you have somebody next to you who's kneeling down on the floor. They're saying whatever they want, but look what he says. Hamakom bifnim mishamish lemiskad yishmaelim. He says, this building, this edifice of the Ma'aris HaMachpelah serves as a mosque. For all intents and purposes, we consider this to be a mosque. And that's what it was for 700 years. 1267 to 1967 is a long time. It served as a mosque for a long time. He said, yes, there's a designated area for Yaakov and Leah. But he said, everywhere else, they are worshipping their religion. How could it be? Lishboch siach lefnei bari olam. How could it be that we are going to offer a tefillah and try to have a relationship with our God? Lefi amunaseinu ha'amitis, according to our religion that we believe in. B'makom tefillah shalahem lefi amunasam. How can we offer a tefillah in the same place that they're offering a tefillah to their religion? V'gamzos disifreim be'amunasam akozevis. He says they have their books lying around all over the place there. They have the Quran there. He says they have all of their famous psukim, all of their very important laws, written out all over the walls. If you go to Ma'aris HaMachpelah, you see it's etched into the walls. Ulamala, he says, on the top, on the ceiling, you see that they have the tzuras chatzi levena shelahem, they have the half a moon, which is their symbol. Hareha halachi, isn't there a halacha she'asu likanes lebeis Avodah Zarah? Don't we know that you're not allowed to enter into a place which is a makam Avodah Zarah? So how are we allowed to go there? How can we offer a tefillah? So we've just gotten into discussion whether Islam is Avodah Zarah or it's not, but for Jews it certainly is. So how can we enter? The same way we're not allowed to go into a church, even though we might not hold that Christianity is bona fide avodah zarah for them, we're not allowed to enter a church, we're not allowed to offer a tefillah in there, just like Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't offer a tefillah in the middle of Mitzrayim. So how are we allowed to enter the Maariv HaMachpelah and offer a tefillah there? Asked the Tzitzit Eliezer, I don't understand it. So I think the answer that my father told me a long time ago was the following. We have a principle in Halacha that is stated that Ein Adam Oser Davar She'eino Shelo. A person cannot take someone else's property and say that it is prohibited. So take for example, there's such a concept as a neder. I can take a promise upon myself, I'm not going to do X, Y, and Z. So I can say, I wouldn't do this, but I can say, I'm never going to eat the potato chips that are in my house. Again, I'm trying to lose weight, so I say, I'm never going to eat that. I can take an item that belongs to me and say, this is now prohibited. I can take an item that belongs to me and say, my car now belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, right? If I say that, now the Beis HaMikdash owns my property, I'm not allowed to use it. The Beis HaMikdash has to figure out what to do with it. Maybe they'll use it for whatever they want. But I'm able to do that. Let's say you come along and say, Schechter's car belongs to the Beis HaMikdash. What right do you have to take something that belongs to me and invalidate my usage of it? You can't do that. You can't walk into my house and say, Schechter is never allowed to eat those potato chips again. How can you say such a thing? They belong to me. They don't belong to you. You don't have a right to take something that belongs to me and destroy it. So look at the story in the Mishnah of Avodah Zarah, Daf Mem Dalet Amud Beis. Number test on the second side of the sheet. The Gemara tells us a story. Shaul Pruklis ben Flusvis. Strange name. Es Rabban Gamliel ba'Akko. One fine day, the great Rabban Gamliel is walking down the street in Akko, in his community. And this philosopher, Pruklis ben Flusvis, stops him in the street. He pins him to the corner. He says, excuse me, I nailed you. You claim to be an Orthodox rabbi? I'm going to prove to you it's not true. He says, what are you talking about? So he says, I saw you, Shehaya Rochitz b'merchot shel apodriti. What does that mean? He says, I saw you that you were using the public bathhouse that has the idol in it of apodriti. What is that? What? So what was that? They believed he was the god of the waters. So they put up an idol in the bathhouse because they assumed this god was the one who was blessing the waters. This person goes over to Rabban Gamliel. He says, I saw you going to bathe in there. You claim to be such an Orthodox person? You claim to be a rabbi? I saw you going and taking a shower in there. And they have an idol. What does he say back to him? Amar lo, he says, you're not allowed to go and take part and participate in a place where they serve Avodah Zarah. So, why are you going there to bathe? What does he say back to him? I didn't come to a place of Avodah Zarah. He ba bigvuli. Excuse me, I've been using this bathhouse for a very long time. Now some crazy people in our community decided to put the statue in there. Now it becomes my problem? What right do they have to invalidate my usage of this bathhouse? It was a public bathhouse. We were all using it. B'shalom u'v'shalva. Everyone was happy. All of a sudden, a bunch of crazies come along and decide to turn it into something else. I came here first. And similarly, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah has the following story. I buy a house. My house happens to share a wall with the next door neighbor. Let's say. So I used to have attached houses. They still have. So my wall is the same as my neighbor's wall. We both use it for whatever we want. So now, says the Gemara, I'm living very peacefully in my house. My neighbor decides he can get a good price. He decides to sell his house to a church. The church puts up all the Avodah Zarah against that wall that's shared between me and him. So now every day I'm going ahead, I'm doing different things on the wall. And on the very other side of the wall that I'm sharing with the church, they're doing whatever they're doing. So the Gemara says, do I have to move out of my house now? Do I have to sell the house? Do I have to knock down the wall? Because how can I use such a wall? After all, it's the same wall that's being used for Avodah Zarah on the other side, and we're sharing the wall. Says the Gemara, no. I came here first. I bought the house. When I bought the house, all four walls of the house were usable. Now they decided to bail out on me and sell that wall to the Avodah Zarah. That's not my problem. My house is still my house. Nobody has a right to come and say that my property should become usur. Nobody has a right to say that something that belongs to me should become invalid. Which Tosis asked the question, if that's true, that nobody ever has the right to do that, Tosis asked the question, then what happens if I have a very delicious chicken soup cooking on my fire, And now all of a sudden someone comes along and pours milk into the soup. So what's the soup? The soup is treif. How can somebody else come and make my soup treif? So you say, no, no, it's in there, right? In the end of the day, there's milk and meat in the soup, so of course it's treif. Yeah, but how can someone else do that? The same way that you say the milk and meat is in the soup, you'll say, my wall is being used for avodah zarah also. That's the fact. So that's a difficult question. How do you figure that out? Why that should be different? But basically, the halacha is in general, somebody else doesn't have the right to come along and asser something that belongs to me. And based on that, and this is why the history is very important, based on that, the general consensus is, when was the Ma'aris HaMachpelah actually built? Someone mistakenly said last night, in the times of Adam HaRishon. That is not true. When was the Ma'aris HaMachpelah actually built? Ma'aris HaMachpelah, the understanding is that it was built in the days of Herod, which was 2,000 years ago, Hurdus. The understanding was that the Ma'aris HaMachpelah was built by the Jews and used by the Jews. Now, later on, even though it was 700 years, but later on, someone else came in, took my property, and decided to use it for some profanity for their own reasons, for their own purposes. You're going to tell me that now my property becomes invalid? Now I'm not allowed to use it? Now that's going to prohibit me from using my own wall? Now I'm not allowed to go to the bathhouse anymore because they decided to destroy it by putting an avodah zarah in it? That doesn't work. Ein adam osa davar she'eino shelo. So we generally assume, again, it's a big question in history, who built the Ma'aris HaMachpelah. But even though we might assume that Islam might be avodah zarah, might not be, even though we assume it's certainly avodah zarah for a Jew to participate in anything from any other religion, but still, the rationale, the justification why almost all the Gedolim and all of the religious people have assumed that you're allowed to go and enter into the Ma'aris HaMachpelah and offer a tefillah there is because we assume that this was our building. We were the ones who constructed this. Nobody ever has a right to come along and tell me that something that belongs to me, that something that's in my property is now becoming undermined, is now becoming prohibited territory. They don't have a right to do that. They don't have the ability to do that. Let's remember, as we celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, and we also celebrate 50 years since the reunification, not only of Yerushalayim, but of Hebron, let's remember how blessed we are. Let's think about what the Rambam writes, that the days that he visited Yerushalayim and the day that he visited Hebron, respectively, were 2 days on his calendar that he considered to be Yamim Tovim. He considered them to be incredibly festive days in his calendar. Let's remember that this is where Kalev ben Yefuna went to Davin. Let's remember this is where Yirmiyahu HaNavi chose to Davin at the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. This is such a central part of our religion. It's such a central part of everything we believe in. And let's hope, V'nasati Shalom Ba'aretz, that it will at some point become a very peaceful place, like the Medrash tells us, undisputed, a place where we have every right to be and a place where nobody will come and contest the fact that we have a right to be in this place and to daven there very freely. Yes?